You're listening to the Bearded Theologians podcast, hosted by Zach Bechtold and Matt Franks. If you'd like to learn more about the Bearded Theologians, you can go online at beardedtheologians.com, where we have past podcasts, blogs, and a couple items for sale. So check us out, beardedtheologians.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy this week's show. You're listening to the Bearded Theologians podcast, hosted by Matt Franks
and Zach Bechtold. And we have a very special returning guest with us today, pastor and author and just all around wonderful human being, Kara Edson. Thank you for being back with us.
Thanks. It's so awesome to be back. It's great to see you both.
Yeah, thank you. Why don't you remind our listeners, you know, who you are, where you're from, a little bit about yourself?
I'm Kara Edson. As you said, I live in Tonganoxie, Kansas, which is between very close to Lawrence, Kansas, home of the Jayhawks. So for reference, if for folks who aren't familiar with the state of Kansas, I live on 10 acres with my husband. We have goats and chickens and a huge, huge garden. And this is my second book that I've published. Stay a While, and published with Westminster John Knox, and they are absolutely amazing. And I also serve two small congregations in McLeod, Kansas, and Oskaloosa, Kansas, which are also about 15 minutes north of Lawrence, Kansas. So they're two small communities. I've got lots of farmers in one, lots of former teachers in the other, and they're really amazing places to serve. So.
Awesome. One of the things that I love about you and having you on is your experience with rural church, right? Having a 2-point charge. You don't get many authors that have a 2-point charge, right?
Yes. And it's a great 2-point charge too. Like I get really excited every Sunday morning. They're really, really great folks. So
yeah. I love that. You know, being out in Montana, everything's just about a 2-point charge to be out here. I started with a 3-point charge and, you know, and I think everybody should serve multiple churches at the same time. There's nothing
it's
like
so,
it.
Oh, when it comes time for paperwork, it's such a nightmare.
That part's no fun, no matter what church. But yeah, there's never a dull moment, right? There's always something in those communities to draw you in and to have a whole lot of fun with.
Absolutely. And you can't believe like how much a small community has going.
Oh my gosh.
Like they have something like every weekend. And so it's like, well, which community am I going to go to this week?
Right. Yeah. Where do I get to show up and be just have a blast?
Exactly. Yeah.
I love that.
Or go to a 4-H show where most of my youth are showing animals. Yeah. So didn't prepare me for that in seminary, that would be part of the job, but I love it.
That's fun. Yeah. Go ahead, Matt.
No, I was, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a blast. I they don't prepare you for 4-H, right?
No, they really don't. And quite frankly, they should, because so many of us are serving in rural environments and it's something that we should be prepared for, because a lot of my colleagues don't come from rural environments.
Right.
And so they're not prepared for what that's going to look like.
So. Yeah, they should teach us how to, you know, drive tractors and, you know, judge goats and.
Well, actually, there is a really cool program at Princeton called the Farminary. Okay. That's a part of Princeton Seminary's program where they actually have an operational farm that is owned by the seminary. So they're actually doing some really cool work up there.
That's awesome.
I always found that to be a great way, though, to connect with the community and be like, hey, I want to drive a tractor.
Yep.
Yes.
Like I, you know, or, you know, teach me, like I learned volleyball in the very first church I served in was a small community. And I was like, I had to learn the rules of volleyball. Because that was a big sport for them and their girls team. And so like, it's what I did. And so, you know, like those non-prepared, you know, you don't pay $1,000 to go sit through. I'd much rather have the on ground than the pay from an academic who's been so lost from reality.
Right. Right. It's like, sometimes this is ministry.
Yeah. Love it. So you have a new book. It's called Stay a While, Advent Lessons in Divine Hospitality. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So part of the inspiration for this book came out of the pandemic. In the pandemic, obviously, all of us were really isolated. I was even more isolated than I feel like some folks were. We live out kind of in the country, like I said, on 10 acres. And so, I can go days if I'm just at my house without seeing another human being besides my spouse. And I have really severe asthma. So in a time before the vaccines were available, my husband, in addition to, his 60-hour a week law practice, also was coaching the high school boys soccer team. And so because he was coaching before the vaccines were available in 2020, as a way to protect me, he actually moved out of the house for 3 months while he was coaching just to keep me safe. And then he would come, we would have porch dates on the weekends. And so we would sit, distance apart appropriately, and he would come visit. But so I was basically living here by myself, completely by myself with the goats and the chickens. And it was that was it. I didn't get to see another human being for those that time. And then I finally get vaccinated in the in spring of 2021. I've been vaccinated for 2 weeks. I've been fully vaccinated and like safe for 2 weeks. And then I had to go back into complete isolation because my father was getting a stem cell transplant and a bone marrow transplant, and I was moving in with my parents to be one of his primary caregivers during that time. And so I was then isolated again for another 6 weeks, with just my parents for company. And we did, my mom and I drove each other a little bit crazy, but I think that's probably pretty normal for adult children moving back in with their parents. And in the process of all of that, I completely missed out. And the thing I missed the most wasn't necessarily gathering in church. The thing that I missed the most, not only about my life, but my job, was gathering around tables with people I love. And that laughter and that community and the food, if the food's decent, it's a good time, right? Like the food doesn't have to be spectacular or fancy. It just needs to be edible. And then it's the company that we have when we spend that time together. And so on the other side of that, I started thinking through what are the parts of hosting that I love so much, and what are the parts of having those community gatherings that I love so much. And so I went through and started to also think through how that might inform how we welcome God in the incoming Christ, in the coming of Christ in the Christmas season as we prepare for Advent. What are those parallels between how we prepare our homes for guests and for beloved company, and then how we prepare our hearts and our souls for the coming of the divine? And the parallels were really, really abundant. And so I got to really lean into this thing that I really love to do, which is provide hospitality. And I also got to lean into this thing that I really love in exploring the theme of Advent, because I feel like our world is like, Christmas has arrived the day after Halloween. And Christmas isn't here yet. And sometimes my parishioners get tired of me reminding them of that. But this is supposed to be a season where we prepare. And if you just jump straight into the main event, like you're not fully ready for what's to come. And so, yeah, that's kind of the heart of Stay a While.
I think you broke Zach's heart because he starts Christmas about mid-July.
I start Santa music that early. I will keep Jesus. You be
You
more
know what? There
time.
is no judgment in that. I actually have all, I have everybody's Christmas gift already purchased except for two family members who can't decide what they want. And part of that is out of professional necessity, because you all know how insane the month of December is in ministry. And I like getting presents for people. I like wrapping presents for people. I love Christmas, don't get me wrong. And I want to enjoy that process as opposed to be stressed about it in the midst of the insanity that is the life in ministry in December. But that said, I think from a spiritual perspective, it is important that we at least acknowledge that there is a season of preparation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about it. We're gonna anticipate and wait for Jesus.
Yes.
We're gonna sing Wham! November 1st.
You know what? It's both and. It's that classic Christianity, both, you
That's
know,
right.
now but not yet.
Right.
So
Yep. It's fun. And it drives Matt
definitely.
Crazy, so it's even better.
It doesn't drive me crazy. I just try to, like, you know, like, give me some space. Like, let me enjoy Thanksgiving. Let me enjoy Halloween. Like, let me have those moments, and you just quit talking about it. And so that way I can have those two holidays, which are very important to me.
So I feel like I'm resonating with both of you in
yes.
that, like, I'm like, yes, yes, wait for it. And then also, like, I'm asking my sister if she wants to go in on a Christmas gift with my dad in, like, early September. And she's like, Kara, you need to wait till at least October to talk about this.
My mother-in-law was classic for starting to buy Christmas gifts in January. She would buy all year long. It was insane. She was prepared.
Well, I told my sister, which she made fun of me. I was like, well, I just bought something for you last week for Christmas that I saw and I thought of you and I thought you'd like it. Should I return it? And she's like, oh, well, no, for me, it's fine.
Love it. So back to the book, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I love the parallels between how we welcome each other in and how we welcome in Christ, right? The anticipation, the preparing for it, you know, making sure the things are where they need to be. And because of the busyness, right? Because of the chaos that December is for everybody, not just clergy, right? December's bananas.
It is.
There are just a lot of obligations, and it's easy to kind of ignore preparing and the details in which we would not ignore otherwise, right? Like, Easter seems to be a time that we prepare better for. We know we're going to have sunrise service. We know we're going to have Easter lunch with the family. We know we're going to do these things. And it seems to me, at least in my experience, Easter's a much more calm season in all of that, where Christmas is just an Advent are hectic. Because the world around us is hectic, right? And so I love the intentionality. Not only are we preparing and waiting for Jesus, right? For that birth and that celebration, but also, what does it look to gather people around the table? Because I'm with you. Give me a table over a pulpit any day. Come on.
Absolutely. And that was one thing I also I lost track of, in that I was in campus ministry for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And when I left campus ministry, one of the many reasons I was devastated when that happened was that I had my students in my house at least mm-hmm. twice a week, sometimes up to four times a week. And so a huge part of my ministry and a huge part of my profession was just hosting and opening up my home to other folks. And when I lost that, it was all of a sudden, like, we looked around and we were like, it's so quiet here. Like, and it's not that we couldn't still invite people over, but it wasn't this built in, folks are coming all the time. And it was both a little bit of a relief at first, because it was like, oh, this space is my husband and mine again. But at the same time, that loss of that community that was right there in our home was really devastating for us, for I think both me and my husband, even though, you know, like I said, he's a lawyer, but he was still really, really close to a lot of my students because they were in our house all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel the same way. I did campus ministry for a bit, and yeah, losing that, or making that transition out of that connection with young adults and people who can come over, and there's right. space for that, and going into the church where you pastor people birth to death, right? It's harder to do. It's harder
it
to
is.
Do in a ways.
That said, though, a group of my students, I've been out of campus ministry for almost 10 years now, and a group of my former students all got together this last weekend, and they sent me photos of them with their spouses and their kids. And so that community is still in existence, even
right.
though they've been out of college and they've been out of that ministry for so long. And it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Like, I got the photos and I just started crying. I was like, oh, my babies have babies.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, and, Even though they weren't that much younger than me at the time.
100%. Yeah. 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 And I think, but I think one of the things to think about, and this is something we kicked around because we're not going back for Thanksgiving this year. And it was something we kicked around at the house before another, before our opportunity that we're going to now came up, was that we talked about hosting a Thanksgiving dinner at the church and just inviting those that don't have that space, because those are the people that get lost more than anything. And I was listening to a person at my lunch group on Friday talk about that, that like, we don't really have anywhere to go. Like, we're going to go to Black IP for Thanksgiving. And, you know, I was just like, you know, there's a whole community that's missed, that if we could just, you know, I mean, if we as clergy have nothing to do and we want to have that space, what a great way to come. And a lot of us have those opportunities, like those spaces where we could actually do a good sized Thanksgiving dinner. You know, I've lived in parsonages where that wasn't the case, where I'd have to go cook it at the church. But, you know, I think that that, you know, that could be something, like, especially as we enter into this Christmas season. And that's where, you know, our Blue Christmas idea, you know, the Blue Christmas comes into play, but there are people who aren't necessarily struggling, but just lonely, and help bring them along through whatever it is you're doing, whether it's a meal or Christmas caroling or all those things, like, you know, and say, hey, like, come be my date with this, like, come be my plus one or my plus six, or, you know, like, whatever. Yeah. And I think we don't give ourselves permission enough to do that. I think we just kind of, you know, we make that open invitation knowing that those people aren't probably going to come because they don't feel like they have the space, but literally giving them the space to say yes, like, or to not say no, I think is something that we're missing in the church. And I think that that can start with a simple, you know, a lot of us clergy don't necessarily have the ability to go home or be with our families. And so why not create that space for that to occur?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that that is, you know, there's a reason. There's a reason why our one of our sacraments is breaking bread and the cup and the bread in communion. Like, that wasn't just Jesus chilling out with his friends and being like, we're just going to have some wine and bread. They were having a meal together. Like, that was what they were doing as a part of that. And that was a part of the community. And I don't even know how many passages there are in scripture where Jesus is just sitting down eating with people. Mm-hmm. And that's such a fundamental part of how we connect with one another. And I had a doctor I was working with once who was, you know, she was all on this, like, everybody should be at their ideal weight kick. I don't go to that doctor anymore, but she was like, I said something about, well, my church had a potluck this week. And she was like, why does your church have a potluck? Why not have a 5K fun run where everybody can exercise together? And I was like, because nobody would come to that.
Nobody wants to do that.
And I appreciated part of what she was saying, which was that, you know, like, every day can't be a holiday and we shouldn't eat every day like it's a holiday. But at the same time, there is something sacred and there's something holy in breaking bread together. And I think that we, in some ways, do that really well. Like, my churches do potlucks like nobody's business. And even in the churches I've served where there were no resources, they could still kick out one heck of a potluck. Mm-hmm. I see Matt's face, right? Like, the churches you've served where, like, they had nothing and the building was falling apart. And yet when you had a potluck, like, you went home full.
And with a lot of, like, stuff to feed you for a whole month, because they would give you all the leftovers. And you know, that's something I know I miss a little bit of, is it's not something I experience so much now. And I miss that. Like, I was at a funeral a while back, and I was like, where's the funeral dinner? And they're like, we're not doing one. And I was like, no, like that's almost one of the reasons why I came, is because I wanted a good funeral dinner.
There's no funeral?
Yeah.
Did you really have a funeral if there weren't funeral potatoes? I mean, come on.
Right.
Yeah, we did our first potluck. I've been here a year and a half. So it's this church's first potluck that they've done in at least 4 years, if not more. It's the first one I've done in probably five. because of COVID and all of the things. And yeah. I told my hospitality team, I was like, I don't know how to do a potluck anymore. I don't know who's going to show up. I don't know what. We may have a crock pot of ham and some potato chips. We're going to have a blast, though. And people showed up. It was so much fun. And you're right. There was nobody went home. If you went home hungry, it was your own fault.
Exactly.
But just watching, because I got down there late because, you know, they went right after church and I had to shake hands and kiss babies and do all of the things, right? And so by the time I got down there, everybody was already seated. They were eating and just fellowshipping and just holding that sacred space around those tables that they hadn't sat around in a very long time. It was heartwarming. It was really cool. And I had a young lady who just lost her grandfather over the weekend or last week. And she texted me afterwards. She was like, classic old lady potluck is exactly what I needed. She's
Aww,
like, I just needed that space.
It.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome.
Well, and I think that because Christmas has become such a consumerist season in our culture, the very foundation of consumerism is what is wrong with my brain? The system where the economy is based on. Oh my gosh, my brain.
Capitalism, is that what you're looking for?
That's, yes. That's okay. The word I'm looking for. You know what? Some days it just doesn't happen. Like you're like, aren't you? Don't you make your word, their life with words? Like you make a living with words, and you just can't come up with them.
Sometimes they're hard.
You know, sometimes words are hard. My husband and I give each other a really hard time when we have trouble because we're like, oh, it's a good thing we make our living with words.
That's right.
So basically, like this consumerist idea is totally based on capitalism. And the fundamental idea of capitalism is this idea of supply and demand. Mm-hmm. And so there's this totally abundant myth of scarcity in our culture. Mm-hmm. And I talk about that some in the book too, that is part of what we're talking about in this idea of hospitality and this idea that there is enough, this idea that there is an abundance in the realm of Christ and in the gospel. And there's this amazing, amazing, have you guys heard of Flamy Grant?
Oh yeah.
So in her song, Good Day, she sings, you were afraid there was not enough, but you can't run out of love. Mm-hmm. And I love that line so, so much. You can't run out of love. And so I think that, you know, even I talk about in the book also about like potlucks when I was in seminary and, you know, we didn't have anything. Like we were not always sure where the groceries were going to come from. And yet when we got together and we had good food, like there was always enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I always find that amazing that like, and you guys have probably had this experience that like when you have a potluck and people are freaking out that more people showed up than what they had dreamed of. Uh-huh. And I'm just like, it's okay. Like it's a potluck. Most people will know not to like take all the potato salad. That will be fine. Like, and there'll always be enough. Like, I don't think I've ever been to a potluck that the church ran out of food. I've been to family potlucks where we ran out of food, yes. But that's a whole other story. That's not sacred and holy. Like right. The moment that it enters a church kitchen, it multiplies regardless. It's in the Bible. I mean, Jesus took five loaves, two fish and fed 5,000 people. So all kitchens are blessed. And you can take that theology however you want to. But I think that sometimes we pray the church has really fallen victim to scarcity because mm-hmm. we want to keep up with the Joneses. We want to see, like, we want to have all the things when in reality, like, I don't know. I like some of my best memories so far in ministry come from my small churches that I've served in just because there is so much grounding in having that space that you have some sacred space that you don't have when you get, you know, really over after you get over 100, some of that sacred space that you have with some of your congregation does dissipate. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those things that the more we work towards providing that space, especially as your church gets larger, or, you know, even as you decrease, like looking at how can we provide space to do, be more hospitable. It really does open you up for some good conversation, but also some like, it's going to be okay. Like if we run out of food, we run out of food, like Domino's is around the corner, like, or, you know, there's somewhere like, you know, it's not like we can't go without. I mean, I've been in a town that literally had no grocery stores, but yet if we knew we were going to run out of food, we knew we could go to the gas station and pick up whatever we needed. You know, I think that helping our people really be okay with what we have, I think that's the real challenge that we have right now that we're not talking about, and that we're just, you know, we're talking about limited resources. Like, we hear it all the time. We don't have this. We have limited resources. People are leaving and all this stuff. It's like, why can't we lean into what we have and do good for what we have, and more will come from that.
And that's kind of what I've been talking about. I've been leading some workshops on leadership, leading excellent worship in the small church. And that's a huge part of that idea, is that yes, the small church doesn't have the resources. Yes, I don't have professional musicians playing I don't have a professional band up front, but I have, you know, a high schooler with amazing talent. And so let's put her up front. Let's give her some responsibility. I have a gentleman that is amazing at guitar. So let's give him a chance to play every once in a while. Let's give it some concert space for the kids that are in the choir that are prepping to go to the state competition. Let's give them another space to sing in. Mm-hmm. And part of what's beautiful about that is that in that community of a small church, the expectation is not necessarily perfection. The expectation is participation. Because if one of the kids plays and doesn't play very well on the piano, it's okay, because he's ours. Mm-hmm. And we all love him and we've watched him grow up. And so there's this beauty in that, and there's this freedom in that that we don't necessarily always embrace. We just look around and go, oh my gosh, there's a beehive living in the walls and there's honey coming down and I don't know how we're going to pay to get it removed. Like, you're preaching and watching honey roll down the walls. There's a sermon in there somewhere about milk and honey, but I haven't figured it out yet. So, yeah, it's thinking through, what do we have in abundance as opposed to what are we lacking?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's, I think that's the gift that our rural churches give us, right? They teach us, they know what it's like to have gone without, whether, you know, they graduated their last kid out of the church 10, 20 years ago, right? Or space or musicians or whatever it is, they show the resilience and the vitality to say, oh, here's what we got, right? And we're just going to run with it and do beautiful things and meet people where they're at, where, you know, churches and other spaces are having, or especially during COVID, we're having conversations of how do we save the little church, because they don't have the they're doing it way better than you are. Get a grip, right? Like, because now you're dealing with having to pull back and you're having limited resources and not seeing people and doing the things where, you know, our rural churches have been doing it for years and killing it, right? And are huge vital pieces of their community and aren't worried about something like a pandemic, you know, fully, right? Like, they just picked up and many of them just picked up and ran, right?
Right.
and have come out of the pandemic better, right? Yes. And have hit the ground running and are doing potlucks well before the larger churches and, like, you know, gathering around the table well. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan. And I say that knowing that I serve a larger church now, but have such an affinity for the rural churches and folks doing that sacred work, because I think as a whole, a lot of them see it as, let's just gather around the table. If we can't do anything else, let's just sit around the table.
My church in Oskaloosa taught me this really, really important lesson after my first book came out, after A Time to Grow came out. I had just started there. It was kind of an unusual Methodist appointment. I started in January. Long story, that doesn't really matter. But so I had just been there a few months and I was like, my book came out and I was like, oh my gosh, I have a book. Like, I want to use this for Lent with these folks. And so I was really proud of the children's time moments that I had written in the book. And even though I didn't have a single child at either church, I was like, we're all children of God. We're going to use it anyway. So we had our children's time for the first, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. with no kids in the church. And so I was like, all right, we're going to go back in the Wayback Machine, however far back that is for you, to childhood. And we're going to, because we're all children of God, we're going to enter that space together. And this one week in Oskaloosa, I had a couple people brought their grandkids. And so we had children. So I called them up for children's time and we did children's time together. There was a question during children's time and the kids went back. And then I went on with worship. And my folks at that church surprised me because they greeted me at the door with the answer to the question from children's time. They had been saving that answer. So like for like three hymns, for my sermon, for the doxology, like they've been sitting there with the answer to the question all the way through the rest of, I don't even know if they were paying attention because they wanted to tell me their answer at the door. And all of a sudden I just went, oh, they love this part. And so I start every sermon now with a question. And if I don't, they're like, where's our question, Kara? I actually had somebody interrupt me one week and they were like, Kara. And I was like, oh, no, I'm getting there. I'm getting
it's coming.
There.
It's coming.
It's coming. It's coming. I just had a little bit of preface this week before we get to the question. And so in Stay a While, there are community questions actually that are actually a part because there's liturgy available for the entire series, as well as the small group piece, as well as the individual devotional piece. There's also liturgy available and liturgy resources. And so there's a question, like kind of a discussion question or a community question, I called it, at the beginning of those liturgies resources for each week. And so it's a question that if you're in a smaller location, you can actually ask the question and have responses. If you're in a larger location, you can ask the question and have folks talk to people close to them. And then also I'm going to use it this year too to post on Facebook. On our Facebook page in advance, because we do have a few folks that are still worshiping with us online, even in our smaller places, and give them a chance to respond so that I can share their responses before I get there. And also that would be a great resource for larger places too, to share on Instagram or Facebook or whatever and say, hey, this is the question for worship this week. Be thinking about this coming into worship. So,
yeah. I love that. I love the fullness. That's one of the things I love about the method of the Methodist Church, right, is there's intention behind everything, especially in worship, that, you know, there's nothing disconnected. Each piece is connected.
Right.
And, you know, it leans into those questions and those moments and experiences we have throughout the whole service, right? And that it's not just for, it's for everybody, right? It's for the kiddos. It's for the kiddos at heart. And it's such a intentional way of doing worship that leans into something bigger than just I got to write a sermon every 7 days, or we got to come up with three songs and, you know, something creative for the next week, right? It's just that simplicity of here's the question, we're going to work through it now, here, take what you will and try to answer that question.
And I've learned the hard way too. Actually, this happened yesterday, so if you really want to go on Oskaloosa's website and watch the me go down the rabbit hole with the kids, you can go see it. It's online. But sometimes you ask the kids a question and they go a whole different direction and you're like, okay, we're going to somehow make this work. I think I'm a thief.
That is one of my big fears of always doing those moments, is because I've had enough experience in that it's just like, dear Lord, why did I ask a question? Why did I ask that? Like, or why did I give that child a moment to like take the mic, you know? And that's what it is. They really do take the mic. I mean, and it was funny because you were talking about your children's moments. And one of the things that we started doing here is because we're kind of in that space, we don't really have a whole lot of children, or we call them young people's moments. And so we just invite anybody young that wants to come forward. And we've, like, even last Sunday when we only had our drummer was the youngest man in the room. He stood up and I turned to him and he and I just talked as though I was doing it. It was kind of funny. I was really hoping he'd do a rim shot, but he did. I couldn't get him to do it. So I think that as we think about like crafting those spaces, like you talked about, you're being very intentional with this book on crafting a space for, you know, all that conversation to occur. And Zach even lifted up how our, you know, our worship order really does allow for that if we create the space for it. And I've been toying with that. What would that look like to really have a space? Like maybe with passing of the peace, ask a question like, hey, as you're passing the peace, like ask your neighbor, like, what's your favorite Christmas item or something like that, you know, like, and really work towards making all those pieces connectional. Because I don't know about you, I don't like going to a service where everything's disjointed, where you're singing, you know, you're singing one thing that has nothing to do with what the topic of the sermon was for the day, and, or the scripture even was for the day. And dear Lord, if the preacher doesn't even use the scripture that he'd read from, like, you know, and so like,
I'm going home now.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I was in a worship space a while back, and that was happening, and I just was like, I can't pull out my phone and start playing because I need to be in a worship space. Like, I literally almost had to do the, like, come down. And I think that, like, having those spaces for that is healthy for us, because it takes that pressure off of us having to produce every week. I mean, even if you're not preaching, you still have to produce in some way, shape, or form. Especially when you're in a smaller church, like, you know, I don't miss those days of having to do all that work before Sunday morning, but being able to know that I'm going to be gone and say, all right, so here's this and this, and good luck. But I think that the more we're intentional about giving those spaces for people, we're also helping them be more comfortable with being in leadership, whether it's, you know, leading the SPRC or whatever. But like, we don't do a good enough job of training our people how to worship, and having those elements, I think are key. I think having those traditional elements help our people learn how to worship. I'm not going to lie.
So I actually also included something in this book that I adapted from, it's an adaptation from my friend, Amanda Bennett Baker. So I do need to name her in that. But so I adapted her practice of whispered prayers to repeat after me prayers. And so at the end of each children's time in the book, I have a repeat after me prayer that's ready to go. And part of that is because after every children's time in my churches, I do a repeat after me prayer. So, you know, at camp, when you have those songs where you're like, this is a repeat after me song, and everyone says, this is a repeat after me song. At the end of every children's time, we have a, this is a repeat after me prayer. And so I started off, this is a repeat after me prayer. And all the kids are already attuned to know that they immediately respond. And my both my congregations participate in that as well. And something someone pointed out to me recently was that for adults, a lot of our adults don't know how to pray. And they were like, I am loving this as an adult because it's teaching me, because I'm saying the words, like I'm actually participating in the prayer. I'm not just listening to you with half an ear, and then the other ear, I'm like, oh, what am I doing for lunch today? Like I'm have to listen to repeat it back. And it's this beautiful, it's that call and response that I think, unfortunately, we've lost a lot of in, well, that's not fair. Our black churches and our black siblings still have that call and response alive and well, but in a lot of our predominantly white congregations, that call and response is something that we don't do as much anymore. And so it's really adorable too, because when I pray, a lot of times I'll hold my hands out like this, and I didn't realize this because I had my eyes closed, but two of my little girls at one of my churches also now during the repeat after me prayer hold their hands up like this because they think that's what you do when you pray. And I love it.
I love when our congregations point out those little things that we do that, you know, we just do it and we don't think about it. Like, I've had people say, it's not your sermon until you say, will you pray with me? Because there are some Sundays where I don't feel that, and I just get up and I just start, you know, I dig in quick. And I had that comment the other day, like, you know, just some of those Sundays when you don't say, will you pray with me, I don't feel like you're starting your sermon off right. And so I'm just like, well, that's you know, it's something to consider. And I really do believe, like, my struggle with more modern style worship of three songs, offering and sermon in a cloud of dust, I feel like we lose that connection of community that liturgy provides, that can't be replicated in any other way than doing communal prayers. Or, you know, this last Sunday, I really hope my congregation understood what I was doing here. Everything liturgical was written by an Indigenous person, everything from beginning to end. And so as I'm standing there talking about my connection and what, how I connect into that, like what it means to me, I'm really hoping that someone who, you know, those people that take home the bulletin and like grade it, you know, like really go back and look at those prayers and understand that we had a vast array of people from across the country that are indigenous. And, you know, just, I hope that they caught that little wrinkle that I threw in there without ever having to say it. And it was funny because as I'm wearing my ribbon shirt and my moccasins, everybody's like, why are you dressed like that today? Like, what's going on? And I was like, well, let me talk about that in my sermon. Like, I literally had to tell people, like, can you just wait? I will talk about it. I'm just not going to show up dressed like this and not talk about it. So,
but you should.
I thought about one Sunday wearing a Raiders jersey just to see what kind of rouse I get out of people and talking about God's love, you know, like as heavily Bronco fans as my congregation is, like literally, you know, maybe that last Sunday of the year when they play when the Raiders and the Broncos play each other, like literally going out and saying, like, and coming up and saying, like, you have to even love people who wear these things. So,
you know, yeah. I think that might be one step too far for my folks because we're so close to KU and, yep. And most of my Duke stuff from seminary lives at the back of my closet. And I do wear it when Duke's playing and I'm sitting in my own home, but that might be one step too far for folks in my community.
So I had a funeral earlier this year with a man who was a usher for the Rockies for like 25 years. And I was, the only thing Rockies I really had was socks and a hat. And so I didn't bring my hat with me. I had my socks on. But in my office, and I moved it, I have one of those, you know, those nacho bowl hats that you buy, and it's the plastic hat. And so I put that on before the service and was wearing it before the service. And like, the family was like, you can't take that off. You got to preach in that. And so I left it on. And I said, I kind of feel my head slightly burning a little bit. And, you know, I think those little things that we do are important. And like, what a great season of Advent to have those little wrinkles that we can throw in there just so way people remember them. But it doesn't mean we have to always do them. But it's just like, there are things we can do. Like Zach and I usually do in our churches, we'll do a Christmas sweater Sunday. Yes. And, you know, those things, like, people get so excited about that. And like, they're even almost willing to invite their friends to it. And like, if we can create those spaces for that, we're extending that hospitality that I think gets lost a lot in a lot of churches, because we forget that those little wrinkles that we think are a little squirrely can also have some deep meaning for people.
It's so funny you mentioned that, because I just bought a used Christmas sweater off of eBay like a week ago, because my congregation was like, one of my congregations, they had this tradition of doing that. They call it Crazy Christmas Sunday, or Crazy Christmas Sweater Sunday. Try to say that 5 times fast. And so I was like, yeah, sure, we can totally do that. And then I was like, oh, I don't have a Crazy Christmas Sweater. I'm gonna have to go searching for one of those. So, and thrift stores, it's just, I wasn't likely to find one in a thrift store around here because it's mostly college students. So.
Right.
I do festive Christmas sweaters every Sunday in Advent, and they get more festive as the Ooh. Sundays progress, so that when we do it on the fourth Sunday, you know, nobody's embarrassed to wear a festive sweater. And yes. I had a church member let me borrow a blue and gold sequin suit last
Ooh.
Year. There's some anticipation that I have to up my game this year. It's a ton of fun.
Okay. I like it.
One of the things that I love about your book, you know, we're not competitive on this podcast, but we've had some other people who may be friends and classmates of yours who have written Advent books this year.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, they write 4 chapters. They get us through 4 Sundays of Advent, maybe Christmas Eve, but you take us all the way through Christmas Day and then give us, you know, resources and children's programs. And thank you. That's amazing. But what I really love about your layout, and I'm gonna give the back end of the chapter titles because I think they're important. That you lay it out in the invitation. The invitation's first, right? And then you start with plan, prepare, welcome, stay a while.
and then don't be a stranger. And I love, 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 love that you did it that way, that you make the invitation first, rather than trying to put a plan together and hope and have some sort of expectation of what it should be. Just make the invitation. Make the invitation and then we'll figure it out, right? Which in my brain is how I function. Let's just get people here and we'll try to figure out what it is.
Right. Well, like if I don't know who's coming, how do I know what to make?
Exactly. And so I love that. I love the whole process through. And I love that Christmas Day, don't be a stranger. Because so many, I don't know, I heard it the other day and it pissed me off. I hate the cheesters, right? That term, Christmas and Easter people. I love Christmas and Easter people. If that's the only two services you get out of the year, you're getting great services. All right. You're getting the best of the best of the stories. You're getting the best of the, I mean, you're just getting a full experience. And I love that. I don't think we should demean that by any means. That's a beautiful invitation for people to come and be present for. And I love that invitation with that of don't be a stranger. If Easter's the next time you come, you're not a stranger, right? You're here, you're present, you showed up. And I think there's something very valuable in that.
And there's the separation between, I think that there's a certain level of individuality and the more and more polarized, especially the United States gets, there's these divisions that just keep on rising and rising and rising and rising. And this idea of that in the realm of Christ, within Christians, there are no strangers is an idea that really kind of drew me in as I was working on that chapter, that there is no such thing as a stranger.
Alexa's always wanted to be a part of the podcast.
Hi, Alexa. So one of the things that I that's the story of that. That's the post-Christmas or beyond chapter. And the text is the Holy Family fleeing into Egypt. And so that chapter has a little bit of potential for some of us. I know probably when I use it, it's going to be a little bit controversial. Because we do talk about the fact that the Holy Family were refugees. And this is a very, very upsetting topic for some folks. So upsetting that I preached on it one Sunday a few years ago. And I had somebody that got up and walked out in the middle of the sermon and later told people it was because I said that her Lord and Savior was a refugee and she wasn't okay with that. I'm assuming for the most part, when super conservative folks are reading scripture, that they're taking it quite literally. So I'm not entirely sure what part of my reading was offensive to this particular individual. Like, I don't know how else you read that text if you were reading that text literally, which I know that this individual was. But maybe it was just the fact that I had the audacity to preach on it. But I can't be apologetic for what's in the Bible. So don't know what to do with that.
But that's the thing about the Christmas story, about the Advent story, and leading into that is it's not all peppermints and rainbows, right?
No.
It is a hard story.
No.
And I think we're okay with Lent and Easter and that season being really hard because we're leaning into, the fullness of life, death, and resurrection and having to deal with that. I don't think we give Advent the same, I'm going to say grace, but I don't know that that's right. Because it's incredibly hard. It's not a it's not a Hallmark movie. No. There is joy and celebration, within it, but it is a very, very, very hard, and painful and at times uncomfortable story. And we talked before we hit record about, Noah and some other stories that we don't give equal credit to, right? We stop where it gets uncomfortable. And I think we do that with Advent and Christmas. We stop when it gets uncomfortable and, we move on to Epiphany or anything else.
And I think I tell the story in the book. I'm not 100% sure. I think I do. But I was preaching a Christmas Eve sermon one time, and it was when I was still working with college students, and we had a very, very, conversational style. My preaching was very conversational style at this point in time. So this was not like a rude interruption in the middle of the sermon. I want to preface that. But I was talking about the gruesomeness of that first Christmas and how it's described. And I talked about what straw lice are. And I talked about the fact that you're putting baby in this, and you know, when I talked about all of the bacteria and all of the viruses that are probably circulating in a barn if you're putting a baby in a hay full of manger. It was hay mites. Sorry, not straw mites. Hay and straw are very different. That's important. straw is. Mites, the hay mites that live in there, and just the general uncleanliness. I also, because I was working with college students, wanted to do a fairly graphic description of childbirth, which I'm not going to do here. But so I talked about all of just the bodily fluids and the excrement that come into this story. And how gross this is. And one of my college students looks at me in the middle of my sermon and goes, "I want my first world Jesus back."
I love that. I'm guilty of it too, right? Like my favorite Christmas Eve reading is Jesus wrapped snugly in cloth. Like, it gets me every time. I love that, but not because it's warm and partly because it's warm and fuzzy, but because of what you just described. Everything around sweet little baby Jesus wrapped snugly in cloth is chaos. It's disgusting. And it just, we wrap our little babies snugly so they're protected, right? And so that there's just so much there that gets me, and it reads well, but it also to me just opens up that world of reality that it is nuts. What is going on around Jesus at that current time is crazy. I mean,
I'm positive that this made it in the book. This idea that, you know, if I was going to invite a deity to come into the world, I would not choose an unmarried teenage girl who is under, you know, who isn't even a citizen in the land in which she is living, who's under the thumb of the oppression of another government, who has, you know, now she's giving birth out away from her family because they've traveled. And so she has no mother, she has no grandmother, she has not like the midwife from her community to help her through this. You have Joseph, who, because he's a carpenter, I'm assuming he hasn't birthed a lot of like animals. So he has no clue what's going on, because, you know, men weren't like hanging around the birthing bed in those days. And so like that's who you've got as your birthing assistant, is this clueless dude that has no idea what to do. And I mean, yeah, there's a lot there that is not the ideal situation for the divine to come into the world, when God could have chosen to come into the world in a golden palace, and then had golden diapers. And little reference from old movie there. You know, that this is not the ideal situation. And yet this is the situation in which God chooses to enter the world. And because God wants to be with us, not with us in this like sanitized version of us, not this cleaned up version where we show up and we appear like we've got it all together. God just wants to be with us. And I think that is a really, really beautiful, beautiful idea.
Yeah. I love that so much. I could have this conversation, and I know Matt could, for days, for days. Anything else you want to wrap up in your book and share with us?
It was just such a joy to write. It's been a really huge joy to share with the world. I've been having a really amazing time getting to talk about it. When it first arrives in that box, I'm still a new enough author that I have like a little squeal and cry a little bit. And it's almost like a baby coming into the world, because you're like, I've been working on this for a year. But it's been such a joy, and I am so passionate about this season. I'm so passionate about entering into this season, and I'm really, really grateful also to the folks at Westminster John Knox for giving me this opportunity. And I'm thankful to both of you for letting me be on the podcast today. It's always so great to talk to you both.
Yeah, I think last year you owned the most listened to episode, actually, last year.
Really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly. I'll have to go back and look. I'm pretty sure you were the highest for a very, very long time, if anything.
What? Okay, well, I want to advertise
There
for
we go.
you.
Yes. Look at that mug.
This is legit. I'm not just saying this because I'm on their podcast. This really is my favorite mug. So I highly, highly recommend buying a Bearded Theologian mug. Yeah.
It's mostly because they fit a whole pot of coffee.
They do. They're so huge. Like, I can eat soup out of here. Like, it's totally my favorite mug. I love it.
We love that. Well, I know that between, you know, your episode and the other two episodes we did with, you know, friends and classmates of yours that also wrote Advent books, whoever gets the most listens throughout the years, the Advent study I'm doing
Ooh.
Next year.
Ooh.
And so, like
okay.
I said, we're not competitive on the podcast, but we're a little competitive on the podcast.
Okay. Okay. Well, I will start putting this out there as soon as I see the link.
That's right. We're here to raise the stakes for everyone.
So Kara, we definitely thank you for coming on, and you know that invitation comes out, like, you know, any other time that you want to come on. You don't even have to have a book to come on. We'd love to talk to you.
Thanks.
You know, thank you for joining us. We want to thank our listeners for listening. Encourage you to pick up her book, and you can find it on Amazon or where most books are sold, from what I can tell, when I was looking for it, just to make sure. But we thank our listeners for listening, and for the Bearded Theologians, I'm Matt Franks.
I'm Zach Bechtold. Thanks for checking us out.
I want you to subscribe and like this video and push that thumbs up.
Thank you for listening to the Bearded Theologians podcast. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share on all social media outlets. You can check out old episodes and more information at beardedtheologians.com. Thanks for checking us out.